That's my theme music, Happy Feet. And I'm really happy to be back again. Lucky me, I was in Hawaii last week, so we replayed Sex at Dawn with Christopher Ryan, the co-author. This week, I'm very happy to have with me once again Dr. Hernando Chavez. Hello, Hernando.
Hi, Dr. Diana. How are you tonight?
I am good. I am good. And it's been a year, really, almost a year since we talked about kink and BDSM. And kinky is often about having extra fun with sex. It's about perhaps introducing a little more imagination and creativity into lovemaking. And we have an expert here. He's an expert in a lot of things, actually. He is a California licensed marriage and family therapist in Beverly Hills. You can go to his website, Dr. Hernando Chavez, and that'll be up on the description of this show later. And he is a really sex-positive guy, special emphasis on pleasure enhancement, and he talks about working with erotic minorities, and certainly people involved with kink and fetishes come under that category, don't they, Dr. Hernando?
Well, thank you, Diane. I appreciate that introduction, and you're right. Erotic communities are one of my most cherished and favorite clientele to work with, in part because there's not many clinicians out there who are sex positive and knowledgeable enough to really understand the ins and outs of these different lifestyles and different types of relationships that people engage in, as well as their unique orientations.
You're right. There aren't that many experienced therapists who are sex positive and who have the knowledge to work with these groups. And there are rules for BDSM. The exact open communications involved in power play are really important to keeping everything safe and fun and not dangerous. Tell us why else you really like working with this community.
I'll tell you what, I've always been drawn to the underserved and the people who are sort of outside the mainstream. So I initially started out working with children, and then it turned into LGBT children, so lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender kids and adolescents who are under 18. And I love, you know, working with people who just didn't seem to get the type of attention that I think, you know, is deserved and much needed. And then it just blossomed. Then it became polyamorous and open relationship non-monogamy communities. Then it became the BDSM community. And I started realizing that it's the curiosities that I have with unique sexual expression that's really what draws me to these types of individuals, whether it's people who are involved in paraphilias or fetishes, unique sexual expression, unique relational or family coupled dynamics. It just seemed more interesting to me. I was drawn.
And probably with this, with these kinds of clients, there is never a boring moment in the session.
I'll tell you what, I mean, there's a lot of similarities with traditional psychotherapy as well as what we call kink affirmative or, you know, erotic community affirmative psychotherapy. And really we're doing very similar things, except the one big key difference is we're working in unison with their erotic pleasures and their desires, and it's not considered problematic in their, you know, involved in therapy. When you're working with depression or mental health issues or relational dynamics, for some clinicians, it can get in the way this, you know, their own morals or their own judgments or their own lack of information or knowledge.
That's very true. And some people, I heard a cross-dresser say that the moment he puts on the wig and the outfit, all of the problems from the day fade away. He is into his female self. And his stress and depression sort of evaporate, at least while, and he feels more whole cross-dressed. Do you get some of that in your sessions?
I do. And actually, what I typically do with cross-dressing clients is that I'll open the invitation and I'll allow them and encourage them to decide if they want to come in their whichever gender they feel most comfortable into session, and they can utilize the waiting room mm-hmm. area to change if that makes them feel more alive and maybe even mm-hmm. more able to access some of their more deeper, inner, you know, insightful, you know, processes. And that's always a great way to I think, build trust and rapport, just to allow, I think, an open, safe space for them to really start, I think, looking beyond what society and the judgments are, but some of the internal struggles that they're dealing with.
Yes, and I think most cross-dressers value their macho side as well as their feminine side. But many have never found a way to enjoy both at the same time.
Right.
As I understand it, as young boys, they often showed traditional male behaviors, and as men, they're usually heterosexual. And by the way, that's a myth that many people still hold, that these men are not heterosexual, but they usually are heterosexual, married, and the last guy you would imagine who'd dress up like a girl.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly true. The profile that you're describing is typically white, married, heterosexual, male with a family, wife, and also with there's also a sense of hypermasculinity that they often portray, which is really masking a lot of the insecurities that they have with people finding out about this cross-dressing, you know, desire that they have.
Mm-hmm.
We'll typically find them in positions like welding or in the military or law enforcement or in some power position that kind of, I think, overemphasizes and magnifies the masculine aspects to them.
And, of course, cross-dressing is a fetish, and some people with fetishes get comfort from the fetish that they can't get from human beings.
Mm-hmm.
So the fetish becomes the missing piece that completes their sexual circuit, so we say.
Yes. One thing that's sometimes forgotten about is the impact on relationships, and if they do become married and the separation of worlds, and if their partners find out about it, what's that like for their relationship?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that's where we therapists are often seen.
Mm-hmm.
Because a wife or a committed partner will sometimes discover the cross-dressing inadvertently, walk in on the guy who's cross-dressed, and then it becomes a problem for some. I mean, some women do not find their guy cross-dressed as appealing or mm-hmm. attractive or erotic. And other women have been able to work with their guy who begins to feel more whole,
mm-hmm.
and actually I heard one woman say, we actually have more intense sex. Now, whether he's cross-dressed during their sexual relations or not depends a lot. Has that been your experience too?
Definitely, and I think it takes a certain kind of open-mindedness and
mm-hmm.
to really embrace, I think, something that can be beyond or something different than what your arousal template is. And for a lot of these women, you know, they typically do get very angry. It's a shattering moment in their relationship because
mm-hmm.
the person they thought they married is actually very different than who they really are. And you'll find, too, that, like as you said, when therapists jump in or are invited in, you'll find that there's often a lot of hostility and anger that's associated with this idea that I married one person, but you turned out to be somebody different.
Somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it's complicated to treat these people. You know, I know that for some guys, they started maybe by going in, as little kids,
mm-hmm.
they maybe go into mom's drawers and get out the bra and panties, and then the cross-dressing fetish may kind of slow down and not be evident maybe again until adolescence.
Mm-hmm.
And then it has a real erotic overlay, and it serves to help with masturbation, the erotic images that come up. Maybe they're looking at themselves in female
mm-hmm.
underwear. And a lot of these guys really say it helps them get in touch with their feminine side, which is a good thing. And it can be a good thing because it can make for a better balanced person.
Oh, definitely. I think that if you can find a supportive partner who is interested in learning and exploring and gaining knowledge and understanding, eventually I think there can be an acceptance that can be found where it can be incorporated into a great, I think, broadening of the persona, broadening of the characteristics that we have, from masculinity to femininity to androgyny to sensitivity. And you'll find, too, that couples that can incorporate this into their relationship, even if it's not necessarily sexual, but even if it's more on just a identity level, where a partner is just allowed to dress, or a partner, it's okay for them to dress on certain days, or when they go on vacation, or if they get a hotel room, and you know, that type of support, even if it's non-sexual, can be, I mean, so bridging for closeness and intimacy in a relationship. Because if you think about it from the cross-dresser's perspective, the lack of societal acceptance, the lack of the inability to discuss this with friends, with family, with pretty much everyone in this world because of the isolation and the shame that's associated, to have somebody support it in any way is just it's life changing.
Yeah, when couples can really share this information and make the most of it, then the big secret that's been in place for couples that normally don't have secrets between themselves. And so then it's out in the open and they can deal with it. Sometimes I'll suggest to a woman who contacts me that she's discovered her guy in a dress to wait a few months before taking any action. And then she might be able to see that there are far worse things a man can do than wear women's clothes,
right.
Fashion crime that it might be. Because some of these guys don't have a lot of style, and maybe I heard about one couple where she began to take him shopping so he could improve his sense of style.
I mean, what a wonderful example of embracing a person's, you know, sexual expression and identity.
I think so, and the other thing is that they were both able to get into the role of girlfriends when they went out shopping because he would be cross-dressed. Some couples have a big problem because they have children and they don't want the children to know. And it's usually not appropriate for the children to know. They would be very confused. Would you agree with that, Hernando?
Typically people do want to have that type of privacy, and depending on the age of the child, I think, you know, it can be confusing, but it can also be educational. You know, it can be a great lesson in opening a child's mind or a youngster's mind into the differences that people have with identity and gender identity. You know, 40 years ago, it might have been suggested that, you know, a gay person, someone with an orientation that's different than the mainstream, might be something that a child couldn't handle. But what I've noticed is that kids are resilient, and if society has a difficult time, a lot of times on individual levels, kids, if it's presented in a way that's age-appropriate and understanding and something that they can, you know, grasp on a non-kind of confrontational manner, I found that a number of, you know, like if they have an uncle who's transgender or an aunt who's lesbian, they really do, if it's promoted in a sex-positive environment, they can easily adapt into, I think, understanding and asking questions and having it being very comfortable.
We're using the words accept, adapt. People with fetishes usually love them immensely. And we're going to talk about some other fetishes and cross-dressing. And they resist to giving them up. And so therapy is seldom effective for loosening the love of the fetish. So it's about adjusting to it or getting your partner to adjust or embrace it. And would you not say that's true?
You know, when people approach me and ask, you know, I have this specific fetish or this specific paraphilic expression and I want to get rid of it, can you help me? For me, I think it's ethical to tell them the truth, which is this is a part of who you are.
Right.
If someone came and said, they're heterosexual, can you please make me homosexual? I would tell them the same thing. I'm not, you know, I don't believe that we can change our orientations, but look on acceptance, being able to kind of work on some of the mental health issues associated with, like anxiety or depression or isolation.
Yeah. The shame.
Fear and shame, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And for a lot of people, they actually, you know, don't get into the psychotherapy because of that type of response, which is honest. Instead, they'll go with the people that say, oh, we can work on that. We'll do our best to try to change that. We can make you this or that. And which I find to be a bit unethical because there's no research that supports, no evidence that supports or suggests that we can do this type of fetishistic, you know, change in people's orientation.
Mm-hmm. If both people in a relationship enjoy a particular fetish, then acting out the fetish, you know, can be fun. But if only one partner is into the fetish, the other partner might feel that she or he is not nearly as important as the fetish itself. And that can be tricky. They feel diminished. I mean, for instance, the wife of a cross-dresser might feel, what, I'm not enough for him, I'm not sexy enough, he's got to go and look like a girl. And so it's sometimes part of therapy then becomes helping the person with a little more personal confidence and growth.
Most definitely.
Yeah.
Because I think we do personalize our partner's sexual or gender identity expression.
Mm-hmm.
We really need to, I think, formulate stronger boundaries and be more differentiated to not allow that to happen. For example, if our partner doesn't reach orgasm, you know, some people will internalize that as it's my fault, what did I do wrong, is they're not attracted to me, and they'll start going to this downward spiral of cognitions of thinking that it's about them. And that can really challenge, I think, our levels of confidence and self-esteem, when in fact it could be something different, as if, you know, my partner, it might be more towards them. And that's partly why I think in sexology we encourage the teaching about people being responsible for their own orgasm and the idea of communicating in order to find higher increased levels of arousal so we can do the sensations and the techniques and the touch and the behaviors that do make us, I think, most feel most pleasured.
That's very important in working with anorgasmic women, mm-hmm. that they start to take responsibility for their own orgasm. And it's also important for the man to stop thinking he's responsible for her orgasm. Mm-hmm. I'm going to make her come, kind of thing.
Right.
Let me just pause here for a moment, Dr. Hernando, and say to the listening audience and any of you listening live, and I know a lot of you go to the archives and listen after the fact, but if you want to join the conversation, and if you have a question, you are most welcome to call 888-874-4888. And our wonderful producer, Greg, will take your call and get your first name and or make up one if you don't feel comfortable with your real name. And you are anonymous here. And if you have a question about any kind of fetish or BDSM behavior, we have an expert here, Dr. Hernando Chavez, and you can find his website at drhernandochavez.com. And he also, in our pre-interview, he suggested a website, fetlife.com, and FET, F-E-T, is short for fetish, life.com. And I went there, and it looks like it's a very popular website with lots of members and lots of interactions.
It's definitely a popular website, and it's focused mostly on the kink community, but the
mm-hmm.
fetish community, there's a lot of gray area and overlap. So a person who, let's say we're discussing cross-dressing, would definitely find a home there, because there are groups for cross-dressing, groups for kink, groups for BDSM, groups
mm-hmm.
for fetishism. In addition, people can set up profiles similar to Facebook so that they can create like their own sort of social identity for others to look at and even friend. And it's a great way for people, I think, from a distance to be able to start to get to know the community, get to know people, maybe even join some groups and get resources, maybe events or conferences or gatherings that are happening in their town or somewhere, you know, that they can travel to. But it's a wonderful way for us to, I think, open the door to making fetishism or orientation or identity, you know, differences become more mainstream, which I think is so important, because pre-internet, this was such an isolating identity for people to have.
Absolutely. The internet has made all the difference, because now people can find that they're not alone and they can actually have these kinds of specialized support groups. I think it might be useful to define fetish, and as I understand it, and I want you to please add on, Hernando, a fetish is a reliance on a prop, maybe a body part, a scene or a scenario in order to get off sexually. And the prop can either be fantasized or exist in actuality. And I really like this. One philosopher described a fetish as being similar to when a hungry person sits down at a dinner table and feels full simply from fondling the napkin. Does that resonate with you or not so much?
Yeah, I think that's a great definition. I would also maybe add on, too, as well, that
yes.
People's arousal and desire for this fetishistic expression is so intense that without it can even, you know, inhibit, let's say, orgasm or ejaculation. So they sometimes almost even require it the necessity is so intense that it has to be present.
It has to be present.
Mm-hmm.
You know, quite a few years ago, Randy Newman wrote a song, and it was incorporated with Kim Basinger doing a striptease in 9.5 weeks behind some shutters. And the song was You Can Leave Your Hat On. And so if, and we don't know about this, it's a great strip music, by the way, for a woman to do. Yes, I have tried it. I like it. I like the music. But we could say that if Mr. Newman couldn't enjoy sex unless the woman had a hat on, then we might say he had a hat fetish. But if he could get turned on, if the woman was wearing a hat while otherwise naked, you know, that's fine. But if he could enjoy other aspects of sex with her, whether or not she had a hat on and was naked, then he probably wouldn't have a particular hat fetish. Would you agree?
Yeah, and I think there's different degrees of how much the fetish itself is wired into us, you know, how necessary it is for it to be present. But I think all people have something that they've, you know, found that has been something that kind of ups the ante with their own sexual arousal.
That ups the ante, and that...
For what makes them feel aroused or feel sort
yes.
of excited. You know, I think we all have that. And one thing that individuals, I think, would be so wonderful if couples and individuals did would be to explore these different, you know, types of arousal. We sometimes get in these stuck in ruts, these routine sort of sexual scripts that we don't get out of, and we continuously do the same things over and over and over again. And we don't invite variety. We don't invite differences to find out if something might be even more arousing than what we're experiencing today.
And then the brain is going to produce more dopamine, the hormone of arousal. This is particularly true for long-term couples where they've just been in a sexual relationship, just one with the other. And so if they might explore some of these areas, and it can be kink light or BDSM light. Oh, define BDSM. I think you did the last time we discussed this over a year ago.
Sure. BDSM stands for six terms, so it's a four-letter acronym for six terms, and that's bondage, discipline, domination, submission, sadism, and masochism.
And are there any misunderstandings on people's parts about BDSM, you think?
Well, I think that we're in a transitional phase right now in that we're beginning to explore BDSM on a more mainstream level. We're beginning to learn about it and understand it on a society level, whereas it's kind of coming out of the dungeon, if you will. And this is, you know, I think in large part because of the 50 Shades of Grey craze, the book series that really, I think, opened the door for people to have a public discourse about kink and about BDSM. And I think we're at a point right now where people are starting to learn more and explore more and maybe even incorporate things into their own sex lives. They're gently treading, but the conversations are happening, which is fantastic.
Yes. So, 50 Shades of Grey. An amazing, phenomenal trilogy, and I did read all three books, and it seems as though lots more women read the 50 Shades three books than men. The perceived demographic of its fan base seems to be composed largely of married women over 30. And so people were calling Fifty Shades of Grey mommy porn. And, you know, I think it's really gotten people noticing that there's a rise in popularity of female erotica. And some of this success can be explained by the discreet nature of e-reading devices. I mean, they can read this on the bus going to work, and people don't have to see the cover.
Mm-hmm.
And they've got their it's all on their device, whatever it is,
right,
the Nook or whatever,
Kindle,
right?
Or whatever it may be. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I really like the idea that it gets people talking, and I think the books are just kind of guilty fun and mm-hmm. escapism. Guilty or not guilty, but escapism. And it may also touch on one aspect of female existence, and that would be female submission, and acknowledging that fact, maybe even appreciating it, shouldn't be cause for guilt. And I think after the break, which will happen in a couple of minutes, we should talk about submissive play, women and submissive play, a little bit. And being spanked and bringing more safety into the kink relationship. And maybe even, yeah, before the break, we have a couple of minutes. Hernando, maybe you can talk a little bit about, before and after the break, about the history of BDSM, and starting with the Marquis de Sade. Would you do that?
Sure, sure. And cut me off when you need to, if we need to go to break.
Okay, I will.
So, you know, kink and BDSM has been going on, you know, since the dawn of time, since people began getting sexual. There's always been a dynamic of power that's been introduced into relationships. Whether it's one person who's a bit more assertive or dominant, another person who's a bit more submissive, and or even could be associated with passivity, there's oftentimes been arousal templates that people have been attracted to in the different roles or the different psychology behind what turns them on. And so you'll find that as we look through history, you know, this type of power dynamic is present, you know, through Greeks and Romans and sexuality and Egyptian sexuality. And really when we get into the Middle Ages, we start looking at it in a more, I think, in a way to define this, and people started to look at, you know, what types of behaviors incorporate what, and for example, the Marquis de Sade, who is, you know, from the Victorian era, Marquis de Sade was essentially an aristocrat who had a very intense desire to want to dominate and to also want to inflict pain towards other people, females especially. And so he did a lot of, you know, horrendous things, a lot of heinous things, you know, sexual coercion, you know, penetrative things against people's will, but it was really intense. And so when he was finally arrested, the term sadism came from his name, which is Marquis de Sade.
All right.
And essentially, initially it started off as a derogatory term, which meant that, you know, it was inflicting pain against someone's will. And the BDSM community took it as you know, an infliction of sensation that can cause pain but also pleasure, and it's with people's consent. So it's different. It may look the same look similar. However, the consent piece is the main difference between the Marquis de Sade versus, let's say, people who practice sadism today.
Very good. We're going to go to the break, and I know you're going to want to stay with us for this fascinating, illuminating discussion. And Dr. Hernando Chavez is my guest today. And Hernando, I would ask you before we go to the break, if when we come back, maybe you get your mouth a little bit closer to the phone receiver, because occasionally it sounds kind of soft.
Okay.
Thank you. We'll be right back, everybody.
Happy feet, da da da, happy feet. Oh, I love it.
Dr. Diana Wiley here with my guest, Dr. Hernando Chavez. We are talking about BDSM kink. We talk about bondage by choice. And, you know, there's some feminists who disagree with the bondage piece of this. For instance, consider a feminist lawyer whose favorite fantasy is being tied up and sexually violated. And she occasionally acts out this fantasy with her male lover. Does this contradict her political beliefs? I don't think so, since the relevant issue is the freedom to choose rather than what's being chosen. That's it, choosing. And 50 Shades of Grey involved lots of this sort of discussion. You know, some feminists thought that being submissive sexually as the lead person in the book, the main character, she was submissive sexually. They think it's tantamount to being the victim of abuse. But she chose that, and they actually ended up having a rather emotionally intimate relationship, she and Christian Grey. Anastasia is her name, yeah. So, Hernando,
mm-hmm.
The point about feminism and choosing to do this rather than what's being chosen, it can be an act of, can be, you can feel empowered to make the choices.
Well, and I think if you bring up feminism,
mm-hmm.
you have to look at the history of feminism and how polarized the term feminism has become in modern day.
Mm-hmm.
Really, you know, the feminist movement, I think, began with the denying of rights to women. So when we talk pre-1920s, before women had obtained the right to vote,
mm-hmm.
Before we even had the discussion about women outside of the work, outside of the home working, or even having equal rights or even equal pay, we have to ask ourselves, you know, it's about challenging this denying of rights, this lack of equality. That's true feminism. But we've gotten to a point where we're now basing feminism, or at least using feminism, to decide what's okay and what's not okay for a female to do. But what I think we need to get back to is the idea that a female should have the freedom, just like a male should, just like a individual who's trans or intersex, that all people should have the right to choose
mm-hmm.
For the choice that's best for them. And that is true equality and true, I think, feminism.
Well, I certainly agree with you. And I have found that some people that enjoy this kind of sex play are actually better at sexually communicating than some of the more vanilla couples, because of all the rules and the safe words. And could you please expand on the communication part of it?
Sure.
Yeah.
The communication in the BDSM world, in my opinion, as well as yours also, is that they incorporate communication as a foundation in their relationships. And not to say that people who are outside of the kink world, in the vanilla world, don't, but they mm-hmm. take it to a different place, to a different extreme, to a different level of importance. Before any type of BDSM or sexual behaviors, you know, most individuals will sit down, have a long discussion about what types of behaviors are okay, what's not okay,
mm-hmm.
what turns them on, what turns them off, and they'll set up rules essentially that create a hierarchy of things that they enjoy, things that they're not so comfortable with, and even things that they are hard limits, which they do not want to do. And part of BDSM is about respecting those limits. I mean, we
mm-hmm.
create the boundaries
mm-hmm.
so that we can allow ourselves to trust and feel free sexually. If we were with people that we couldn't trust, you know, how can we take ourselves to the ends of our own sexual arousal if we don't feel that basic need for safety?
Yeah, trust is the centerpiece of all of that, don't you think?
Mm-hmm. And communication is a wonderful way to establish trust. You know,
yeah.
the more that we communicate our you know, safe words, defining them, defining our behaviors, going over. I mean, there are actually checklists, BDSM checklists, that people go through that are 10, 20, 30 pages long of different behaviors.
Is that right?
And people actually will fill them out, especially in the beginning when they're first getting to know someone, in order to know what they like and what they don't like, and then they'll negotiate. And this negotiation
mm-hmm.
process is the cornerstone of kink communication.
Or one of those checklist examples up on the FetLife.com website?
There may be, but I'll tell you what, if you jumped on Google and just typed in BDSM checklist.
Okay, BDSM checklist, okay.
I can guarantee that plenty will pop up, and people have different types. Some focus solely on the bondage, some focus solely on SM, combination of power exchange. Some have all of the acronyms incorporated, so it really just depends on what you're into.
In heavy bondage, as I understand it, having an orgasm is not as important as the bondage scene itself, kind of with its undercurrent of domination, perhaps submission, and sometimes even humiliation. And I have read that people into heavy bondage seem to process pain differently than people who aren't, and that bondage lovers find serious doses of sexual pain to be invigorating and intimate. A little hard for somebody like myself to believe, but I think it's true.
I think for each person, our bodies are different, our brains are different.
That's right.
The neurological responses that we have to sensation is going to be different. On a more simplistic level, some people might, have a very intense sense of smell, and other people may not be able to smell very well. And there are some people that have these incredible palates that can pick up, minute ingredients in foods, and other people, don't have that type of ability. And so I think we have to be aware that everyone's sensation is different, and the utilization of our five senses is going to be different for each person. So some might really enjoy that tactile sort of, intensity that for others might be uncomfortable, painful, and even, discouraged.
I will give homework assignments to some of my couples where they take turns, maybe on different nights or days. But one time she is his geisha, and another time he is her slave. Mm-hmm. And some of these couples will do a little bit of light bondage in their scene, and they seem to enjoy it because they are rendered passive and they have no choice but to totally enjoy what the partner is doing to them. So they don't have to worry about being a good sex partner who provides pleasure in return. So performance anxiety is virtually eliminated.
Mm-hmm. And for a lot of people, too, when they're engaging in bondage, bondage takes, doesn't involve, let's say, an erection. It doesn't involve
That's a very good point.
And that can really help for people who might feel some of that sexual or performance anxiety. Bondage essentially is about restraints. And it's about utilization of different, whether it's rope, whether it's handcuffs, whether it's, scarves or neckties. I mean, how we can limit the mobility and the freedoms of an individual on a consensual basis for erotic pleasure. And for a lot of people, that, learning to tie knots, learning to use rope, learning to be able to properly and safely, tie their partners up in ways that promote both dominance and submission, but also bondage and the exchange of power can be very, very erotic, and it has nothing to do with orgasm or penile, erection or vasocongestion congestion of the female.
Or penetration.
Penetration. We can incorporate those, but that's not traditionally what bondage is about.
Right.
But the psychological arousal of being restrained or being the person who is restraining another person.
And maybe taking turns, sometimes being the top, sometimes being the bottom.
Most definitely.
Now, when you talk about knots and I think investing in some sheepskin cuffs is a good idea, because if you tie your partner's wrists the wrong way, it can cause harm. But in our pre-interview, you were talking about the pleasure chest. And when I lived in Los Angeles, that's where you live now, I remember that place. It's really big, and it's on Santa Monica Boulevard. And you say that once a week they have free educational sessions, not necessarily always on BDSM. But so have you been to some of these sessions? Maybe you've even taught some.
I have, and the great thing about this sex toy shop, Pleasure Chest, is that they have one in L.A., one in Chicago, one in New York, and I believe they're in talks about opening up a new one in another city. And the great thing is that they have a strong component about community education. That's
right.
A really strong, important drive for them. And so they offer these workshops, at least in Los Angeles, every Wednesday night for 2 hours, free of charge.
Free of charge.
Free of charge. And it can be oral sex. It can be anal sex. It can be, I believe maybe this Wednesday, I think it's on threesomes, and they're flying down a prominent sex educator named Reed Mihalko to teach that class.
Yes.
And it's really just a wonderful way for people to begin getting the information, but also starting the process of having that dialogue and that learning experience. Because
mm-hmm.
you brought up an excellent point, which is, you know, the importance of safety.
You
brought up, you know, handcuffs. And,
right.
You know, people who get into some of these more unique and alternative sexual expressions need to have the knowledge so that they can be safe. And
mm-hmm.
if you don't get that first, even with the threesome, you know, you can do harm to yourself, harm to your relationship, harm to your partner in a threesome if you're not, you know, educated about communication, about, you know, defining boundaries, about what's okay, what's not okay. I mean, there's so many aspects and questions that we have to incorporate before we even think about a threesome, because that can enhance a relationship or it can really harm a relationship.
Right. Absolutely. So again, we're back to talking and learning more. I think it's wonderful what the pleasure chest does. And when you taught there, what was your topic?
I'm actually in the process right now of talking with them to teach there. So I've taught at other sex toy shops. I'm probably going to do something along the lines of transsexuality or transgenderism, because they haven't had much on that topic.
And yes.
Again, I don't want to do the same, you know, blowjob, cunnilingus, you know, presentation that they've done that for every, you know, month.
Exactly.
I'm going to try to do something different.
Right. And transgender people are, thanks to, I think, the Internet again, transgendered people are so much more accepted now. And homosexuals for a long time now. Going back to how we opened the show with cross-dressing, transvestites are not so accepted.
Mm-hmm.
It's the culture.
Wouldn't
you agree?
It really is. And if you look at the swing of the cultural pendulum when it comes to sexuality in this country,
mm-hmm.
I mean, in the 1920s, it was women who were fighting for civil rights. In the 1950s, it was African American and black individuals fighting for civil rights.
Mm-hmm.
Gay community in the 1980s and 90s. And
right.
So we're in this place of, I think, specific genres of sexual identities and orientations that are in that fight, which is the polyamorous non-monogamy community, which challenges the idea of monogamy and this idea of, you know, a religious moralistic ideology that's very, very embedded into our country, and the transgender community, which is really kind of like when we look at a person who's gay and a person who's transgender, you'll find that people have more acceptance for, let's say, individuals that are gay or lesbian versus individuals who are transgender, because orientation has been more exposed. I think culturally we've had more discourse, more talks, the fight has gone longer for orientation than it has really for this idea of gender identity and transgenderism. They're just starting out on their fight.
So much of the damage has already been done. Mark Schoen's film called Trans.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure you saw it as I did, where some of these young people that feel trapped in the wrong body have committed suicide.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't feel support. And now they're getting so much more support, and there's so much more dialogue around it. Again, the bottom line is, knowledge is power, and knowledge is so important so that we don't judge these people. I remember being, this was in 1994, and I went to Singapore for, they still called it Impotence, the World Congress on Impotence in 1994, and there were mostly urologists from around the world there. And I was the only sex therapist there from the United States. There was another one there from Italy.
Oh, you stuck out like a sore thumb.
I had a lot of urologists chasing me. Back off.
you were the most sex positive there by far.
Not literally chasing me, but interested. Far away from home in Singapore. But the point, I'm not talking about this to illustrate some of my challenges, and frankly some of it was fun too at this conference, but there was a very well-known surgeon in Singapore who had begun to do the transgendered surgeries, and he had a slideshow. And, of course, we now know, but this was my first exposure to it, that it's much easier to go from male to female than it is from female to male, mm-hmm. because making a penis that's still responsive is much more difficult, whereas they can, the surgeon can cut off the penis and retain some of the nerves, as I understand it, so that it's like he has a clitoris.
Mm-hmm.
She, when she's a she. And but that was fascinating. And the thing that early on in 1994 that brought it home for me was that he said he had these gay, transgendered guys who even as teenagers could not bring themselves to masturbate because they did not like their penis.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know how the hormones are raging. That's a very good example of feeling trapped in the wrong body. And in Singapore, it was dangerous to be one of these guys out dressed in a dress mm-hmm. because the police could come by and raid a club where they might be, and they'd reach down if they could feel a penis beneath the dress. They were arrested and taken to jail. Now, hopefully, Singapore has become a little more enlightened, but they've always been known as being kind of stripped in a lot of areas.
Right.
But, yeah, the transgender community has been through a lot, and there were lots of misunderstandings in our field. Some of them began with John Money, who was a brilliant man, but rather arrogant, and he did some things that turned out to be all wrong, like trying to raise a child as a boy when it was born with female genitalia.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember any of that?
I do. It was as a result of a botched circumcision that occurred with a male infant.
Right.
I think at the time he was he had a theory on gender assignment, and
mm-hmm.
he, in a sense, took an individual and tried to find like a human subject to really, I think, experiment with his theory, which, you know, had a lot of ethical questions in itself.
Mm-hmm.
There.
Yeah, a lot of ethical questions. Well, I don't know about you, but Hernando, for me, one reason I really like doing sex therapy and is that I really think I see our sexuality as core to who we are, and it's fascinating to explore a person's sexuality with them, with talk therapy, of course,
mm-hmm.
different than with a surrogate. And it's just so intricate and so fascinating. And with cognitive behavioral therapy, you can give your clients some homework assignments or your couples homework assignments, and they can come back the next week or the next 2 weeks, and they're already better. It's and that's, you know, they can begin to have orgasms, or they can begin to not ejaculate so quickly. So there's it's really quite different than working with somebody who is depressed and suicidal, which is important work, but I prefer sex therapy, couples therapy, marriage counseling, all of that.
I'll tell you what, I'm a big believer that because of, I think, the hush-hush nature that we have created in society about sex, that people deep down inside, they want to talk about it. And they're
yes.
concerned about it, and it's something that if we can just have a more public discourse and be able to talk with our kids about it and with our partners about it, and, you know, not have this stigma that it's something that's taboo and we shouldn't be, you know, this shouldn't be something made public, or this shouldn't be something that's outside of our minds.
Mm-hmm.
If we can make that transition into embracing sexuality, just like they did in, you know, past cultures. I mean, you look at Greeks and Mesopotamians and Romans. I mean, sexuality was all over the place in
mm-hmm.
different cultures in India and China, and yet for some reason, as we've evolved, so to speak, you know,
yeah, so to
speak, when it came to our sexual openness.
Well, even in my city, Seattle, which has been very liberal. I've only been here 4 years, but
mm-hmm.
very liberal in some areas. I mean, for heaven's sakes, Washington State just passed a make pot legal law, and gays can now marry here. But there's still some prudishness about sexuality in this city. And I discovered that when a couple of weeks ago I was on a local news channel being interviewed about love and sexuality. And they instructed me not to use, and it was perfect, you know, it was perfectly professional kind of upbeat discussion, but I could not use the word intercourse or masturbation. The anchors on this new show were just a little too uptight about a lot of things.
Right.
And so the woman, the young woman who interviewed me when we were off the air said, I want to go to Los Angeles. Because we did several segments, and many of them live, and then they didn't even rebroadcast some of them in the afternoon. So, yeah, prudishness exists still.
It still exists here. I mean, near my office is Rodeo Drive. And
yes, I know.
At the corner of Rodeo and Wilshire, just a little bit north of on Rodeo from Wilshire, there is this beautiful statue. It's a silver statue that of a woman's nude body.
Oh, I remember, but she has no head.
She has no head, no arms. I mean, but so you just see the breasts and the body and the curvature of the butt.
Yeah.
And this statue really caused a lot of commotion for people. You know, people thought that this was obscene, and there was, you know, it was on the news, and I mean, there was so much media attention and hoopla that was being, you know, over this beautiful. It was such beautiful art that I encourage everyone to jump online and type in Beverly Hills nude statue Rodeo Drive. And you'll see a gorgeous photo, and it's so tasteful that I'm just surprised at like the prudishness, as you were saying.
Oh yes, well, it's one of the main reasons why I appreciate having this show. And I'm very appreciative to Gary Null and Progressive Radio Network, because in the 3 years that I've been on the internet radio now, I have never once gotten a message from above to say a censoring kind of thing.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Not once. And I think my show probably is a little edgier than some of the shows on Progressive Radio Network. But I'm very grateful for that, because it's important. It's really important to get out the word and to get out good, solid information. And that's why I also, when I lived in Hawaii, I had an actual radio show in a radio studio that went from Oahu that went to all the neighboring islands for 5 years. And people would call in more than they do on this show. But it got out information. And, you know, in Hawaii, there's still some of the prudishness around sexuality that's a holdover from the missionaries being there. And that was a long time ago.
And I'll tell you what, if people just realize, if they looked at the research and what you know, education has been telling us, is that if we can incorporate, you know, sexuality education into our lives, starting from, like, you know, younger ages up into our adolescence, into our adulthood, we become better adjusted sexually as adults. We have better relationships, improved happiness, improved sexual expression. I mean, you look cross-culturally, we have these skyrocketing rates of depression and anxiety.
Yep.
We're the most medicated country in the world.
We are.
You know, sexually speaking, we have the most, quote-unquote, sexual concerns compared to other countries. And why? And we also have some of the most sex-negative and repressed thinking in regards to sex education, like the abstinence-only sex education. So
yes,
we're really doing it to ourselves, unfortunately, and doing it to
ourselves. Hernando, we need to stop, but we'll continue this conversation in about 2 months. I'm going to ask you back.
Sounds great.
Because they'd like me to stop a few minutes before the top of the hour, and that's what I do. Thank you, Dr. Hernando Chavez. In the write-up, I will put your website and fetlife.com, too, up there. And once again, I've so enjoyed our conversation. I think our listening audience will, too, because lots of good information. And thank you, Hernando.
Thank you, Dr. Diane. I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
I'll be back next week with Dr. Nancy Dreyfus. She's a marriage counselor in New York City. And she has a book called talk to me like I'm somebody you loved. And she does flashcards. It'll be different and nice. And I hope informative. Bye, everybody. Happy thing. Happy thing. Happy thing.